Well, I believe I remember my first agreement with my mom when I was about 4 years old that I wouldn't take extra cookies out of the cookie jar. I think that's what I remember about my first negotiation. We're all negotiators. The definition of negotiation, according to the Oxford Dictionary, and I've never found a better one, by the way, is negotiation is the human effort to bring about agreements between two or more parties, with all parties having the right to veto. So we're all out there making agreements since our childhood, as far back as we can remember. So it's all about habit. Unfortunately, our habits change as we get older. And because negotiations are 100% emotional until a decision is reached, every decision we make in our brain is made in a complete 100% emotional arena. And as we get older and fear of failure starts to set in, you know, the younger we are, the more fearless we are. I mean, I even go back to being 21 years old flying jets with my hair on fire. You know, I was invincible. So it's not till older years that fear starts to set in. And when it does, we change our habits. So if we don't work hard in the classroom to hone our skills of what we brought forward as a child, we're making a terrible mistake. And worse, giving an example, win-win. It's a compromise-based, feel-good, assumption-generating process that costs millions of dollars every day to people. So it's a wrong-minded classroom setting. We've got to get to the classroom setting where creating vision and driving decision are the mainstays of negotiation. And you get that in the classroom, Michael. You're not going to get that just winging it. My publishers, when I first wrote the book Start With No, they demanded that title, and I acquiesced because it was a take-it-or-leave-it deal. They literally told me, Jim, if you want this published, that's the title. And so I went with it because no is a very important piece of the book. But, you know, the perception is that I'm a walk-away guy. I've had people say, well, you teach people to walk away. That's absolutely not true. In fact, it's the exact opposite. We never walk away. So we're told to go away, but we don't make the decision to walk away because out of fear or out of failure. So it's a complete misconception. And also I've had people say, your stuff's too hard. I said, really? Where did you find that in the book? Well, I haven't read your book, but I saw the title, so it's got to be too tough. It's got to be too aggressive. So I think that's the one misconception out there. I'll tell you my favorite story about this. A long time ago, I was in Saigon in 1967, in early December, just about this time of that year in 67, the 1st of December. And I was looking for presents for my grandparents, and they were very special to me. And I was buying some things for others, and my parents were important too, but I really wanted to do something for my grandparents. And I went by a stand where they made beautiful ornate boats, junks, if you will, miniature junks like models out of water buffalo horn that had been carved, and they were really pretty and ornate. And I remember looking at them, and I asked Mama-san how much for the two boats, and she said 1,500 piastres. Now, 1,500 piastres at that time was about $7, and I couldn't pay $7 for one present, even though I wanted to do it for my grandparents, because I only had about $20 total for the whole family. So I said, no, thank you. I'm sorry. I can't do it. She said, for you, special price, $1,400. I said, geez, I'm sorry. I was thinking more like $3. And I didn't want to embarrass her by any means. I didn't want to be the ugly American, so I just apologized. I couldn't do it. I went on my way. And I finished my shopping, and I had $4 or $5 left as I was coming back by the store headed for the base. And behind me came the lady that I'd seen earlier in the day. G.I., you stop. You stop. So I stopped. She said, you come back. She drugged me by the arm back to the store. And she said, how much do you pay? And I said, I don't want to embarrass you. I only have TT money. She said, you tell me how much you pay. I said, I can pay 700 piastres, which is $3.50. And she looked at me and said, oh, gee, you know. I said, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to embarrass you. And I turned to leave. She said, no, G.I., you take.
Okay, so what's the lesson in that story?
The lesson in the story is that I said no, I couldn't afford that. And she never once asked me who they were for. She never once asked me how important my grandparents were to me. And what would it be like in the United States on Christmas when they found these beautiful boats that were this artwork from Vietnam, these hand-carved boats? And what would be the lasting memories my grandparents would have? She never created any vision for me. She was so desperate to make the deal, all she could think about was compromise. And there was no compromise in my negotiation. There was just creating the vision for her, but I couldn't afford it. It didn't fit my budget. Now, I know that sounds really simple, But that's in 1967 in a Third World War-torn country. To me, it's negotiation. It's the mindset. Had I been her, I'd asked who they were for. And then I'd have created a vision of how the gift would be opened and who would be there and what would be the impact. But she never did that. Now, I understand bargaining. I'm very, very good at it. In collective bargaining, I've actually coached union negotiations on both sides, management, government, and union.
Describe for the listeners, what is collective bargaining?
Collective bargaining is when there's two parties across the table from each other, and they bargain with compromise and give and take, and they give up something to get something. And a lot of times it involves, for example, hiding the ball. Now, I know that person in Egypt at the fruit stand, the ugly American, will probably overpay because they don't see it as a game. They see it as being offensive. Yet the Egyptian trader, it's life to him. It's a way of life. It's like our playing football on Saturday afternoon in college towns. And so it's a way of life for him. And for that visiting American, they can afford a quarter, so give it up. And they do very easily. But bargaining is the process of giving something to get something. And what's amazing to me, Michael, is you produce a product, you spend X number of dollars in production, X number of dollars in editing, X number of dollars in advertising and marketing, X number of dollars for the person who's going to travel the world selling the product, and they ask for a discount. And it's interesting, the mindset is, well, I have to give them a discount because it's win-win. Yet you've had all this expense, and then they call it a commodity. And your artwork is never going to be a commodity. Yet you hear that term all the time, because if it's a commodity, that makes it corn or wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade. And it goes down to bargaining of what the market will bear. And if Anheuser-Busch needs enough wheat or corn or barley or whatever they buy, and there's very little of it available, the price is going to go up.
So bargaining is win-win.
Win-win is bargaining.
Okay, what do you mean by hiding the ball?
It's kind of interesting. In bargaining, you don't want the other side to know what you'll take or what you'll accept. Just like Mama San in Vietnam, there was no way she was going to tell me early on 700 piastres. That was what she was willing to take. She was hiding the ball. And in union negotiations, maybe they're happy with their health care plan, their dental plan, and maybe they don't even care about a vision plan. What they really want is a pay raise, and so they'll drive a vision plan, an extended vacation plan, which they don't care about. They'll put out four or five things that they don't want. They'll hide the ball of that pay raise somewhere in there. And the pay raise will be a part of it, but they'll pretend all these other things are more important or as important. So they'll fight hard and try to hide the ball.
Just like she wanted a higher price than you were willing to pay.
That's right. But I didn't hide the ball. I told her I couldn't pay it. And I couldn't. It wasn't a ruse on my part. I just didn't have the money.
So how do you factor in cultural differences when it comes to negotiations?
Well, just like Mama-san, there is no cultural differences in negotiation. But let me tell you what there is, Michael. I'm coaching all over the world every day. I really want the audience to listen very carefully to this. I'm coaching all over the world every day. The secret to culture is respect. The secret to negotiating with anyone in the world, here, there, anywhere, is respect. The demonstration of respect. You think about this now. You hear the term power, leverage, partnership, all these disingenuous words. I mean, the attitude of power. Well, I have the power over the Iraqi people. Now, I have a client in Iraq right now who's a student in my university, and he's doing amazing work, and he's trying to introduce my work to the Iraqi government because he said they don't know how to negotiate because they're all about power, they're all about leverage. And what happens, that demonstration of disrespect builds barriers. The attitude of our negotiators, our diplomats, when sitting in third world countries, comes off as haughty, comes off as disrespectful. I've seen that dozens of times in my work as a coach. People will say little things like, well, you know, those people are this or those people are that. I say, well, wait a minute, stop. You can't load your mind with such disrespect. What do you mean those people? If you think they're not as smart as you, or you think back on the little people in Vietnam, and look how long we were there in that quagmire, and look at the mess we made of it. So that lack of respect, that mindset, and that demonstration of disrespect, that's the whole problem with negotiating worldwide. So it's not culture, it's not studying culture, every brain on the planet makes decisions exactly the same way. They make it with vision in the emotional arena. And so we have no problem doing deals in every culture on the planet.
You mentioned FBI, and it just sounds like a great story. Is it something you can share?
Oh, sure. They came public about 18 months ago. I was shocked. Someone Googled my name and read that there was a blurb from the FBI about me, and because I had signed some pretty heavy-duty confidentiality agreements. And what had happened in the Philippines back when my first book first came out, they had a hostage crisis negotiation go bad in the Philippines, and they lost two people. I believe it was two. And the agent was coming back from Manila, landed at Dulles Airport there in Washington, and was walking by the bookstore and had heard about my book, never saw it on the shelf, and there it was on the shelf. So he grabbed it and started looking at it and became intrigued. Next thing you know, they called me and asked me if I'd come to Quantico, Virginia. I ended up helping them build their whole training package for hostage crisis negotiators who deal with terrorists and hostage takers. They're the official branch of the government that does that. And it was thrilling. I had no idea that what I was teaching in my commercial arena to my clients, I had no idea what I was teaching and coaching could apply to that arena. And when I got to Quantico and got inside the closed doors in the safe room where we could talk, and they said, Jim, what we do, we can't compromise. And there's not one page in your book about compromise. I mean, we can't give up cars and boats and airplanes, and we can't let these people escape. So we just can't compromise. We have to help them see. They've got to discover that they're going to survive. So what came out of that was my teaching on mission and purpose, and the FBI actually went on the internet and said that I created a revolution in negotiation, the biggest revolution in the last 50 years.
That's exciting. So are they actually using the revamped negotiating?
Oh, yes. For example, they're teaching right now agents all over the world, when the bad guy calls and said, if you don't give me $500 million in the next hour, I'm going to cut this person's head off. And the very first thing out of the agent's mouth is, my name is Agent Smith, and it's my purpose to help everyone in this situation remain safe and come out alive. How can you help me do that? So that's a statement of mission and purpose right into an interrogative-led question, which is exactly what we teach. That's a minor point of what came out of the training. I've studied as many of the great men in the world as I could. And I've got a couple that come to mind. When you think of Winston Churchill, and you think of the great radio broadcast of the BBC and the most troubled time of our world up to now and the apocalypse of World War II, and when he said, we will fight them on the beaches, we will fight them in the fields, we will fight them in the towns, we will fight them in the streets. And even if we are subjugate, even if we are overrun, we have every confidence that our children from the West will come and rescue the old. And he was painting a vision of the German troops landing on the beaches. We're going to fight them there. The whole world saw his stone wall of defense attitude, and he had confidence in Canada, the United States, Australia, New Zealand, India. The other children of the world would come to save the old. And he created that vision. That's one example. So he was a master of it. And actually, he was one of the great leaders probably of modern times. The second I think of is President Lincoln, who of course gave the Gettysburg Address, which literally changed the political spectrum of the United States forever. In so few brief words, he created such a vision. It's really amazing. The other thing that I'd point out, the Gettysburg Address, of course, is a giant creation of vision, but there was a smaller one. And Horace Greeley, at that time was a publisher of a famous New York newspaper, had asked Lincoln his purpose, kind of an antagonist. And the president wrote back to Greeley and publicized a letter, you asked me my purpose. My purpose is to reunite the Union. My purpose is to bring the Union together and unite the country. If you asked me would I free the slaves, I would, if it would unite the country. You ask me if I would not free the slaves, I would not free them if it would unite the country. So he created the vision of laser-like focus of what his whole being was about. And I know that there's a lot of writings that a lot of the troops and the families gained strength for him creating the vision of the purpose of what they were doing in the Civil War. And that vision carried them through. So I really believe, and if the listener will pay close attention to the really greats, they'll find them creating vision with words that allow people to make decisions to get behind them.
How does one build trust during a negotiation?
By delivering what they say they'll deliver, by doing what they say they'll do over a long period of time, of providing overwhelming service. If you say you answer your phone 724-365, you better answer your phone 724-365. It takes a long time. But the word trust to me, Michael, is a little bit misdirected. I trust my wingman from pilot training and from the Air Force, the guys I flew with on my wing or I was on their wing. I trusted those guys. But, man, that took a lot of time and work and energy and effort. And there were a lot of people that I never trusted on my wing or I never trusted being on their wing. So I was either on guard or I wouldn't fly with them. So trust is the wrong word. I think the word that we really ought to work on is respect. How do I gain respect? How do I demonstrate respect? And to gain it is because you demonstrate it. I was taught by an old coach of mine and my grandfather to open the door for everybody if I got to the door first, men, women, children. I was just taught to demonstrate respect since childhood. So I think that's the key ingredient, really.
How much does physical stance portray in negotiations?
Not much. Some of the greatest negotiators that have ever lived have been hunched over, old, balding men. They've been people of small stature. They've been crippled, like President Roosevelt. They've been gangly like Abraham Lincoln. It really doesn't play any factor. One of the great negotiators I ever met was blind in a wheelchair and sold life insurance.
Who was he?
Peter Atkins. He was a good friend of mine's co-worker, and I met him, and he was blind and he sold life insurance out of a wheelchair. And he was amazing at creating vision. He couldn't see. The answer to the question is it's not important at all. In fact, it may be the other way around where people pay attention to Columbo, if you will. You know, Abraham Lincoln used to keep his feet out of the stirrups and had the stirrups up by his mid-calf, so his feet dangled close to the ground on a small horse. So he looked out of proportion, looked weird. There's actually pictures of him doing that, reviewing the troops.
Did he do that on purpose?
Yes. He did it on purpose to put him at ease.
Are there things to look for that could indicate the person you are negotiating with is dishonest or the deal is dishonest or a lie?
Yes, when 2 and 2 doesn't add up to 4, or when things that should have been accomplished aren't accomplished and there's no logical explanation, that you know, things start to not make sense. I've had 2 or 3 of those that end up, a couple of them in criminal proceedings, one just recently in San Antonio, Texas. And it was a real estate transaction with a large client of mine, and I was coaching and had been coaching for about 8 months. And there was an issue, and what the city manager was doing and what his brother, the head of the real estate project, money was disappearing, and we could never get a proper accounting. And this went on all 5 or 6 months. You know, you're trying not to blow up the transaction. It's a very important transaction, both for the community and taxes and also for the organization. And it's a tough deal. And eventually we had to ask the district attorney to take a look at this. And after 18 months of investigation, we found embezzlement and fraud to the tune of $5 million. So when things don't add up, it starts to kind of fester over, and you'll see it if you pay very close attention. You'll begin to see the disingenuous things taking place, the manipulations of maneuvers. You know, we recognize it. Actually, I've recognized it 2 or 3 times in my career with clients. I worked at Mr. Wade's Food Market when I was about 8 years old. He had a fruit stand next to my grandmother's in the summertime, and I got free popsicles. And he taught me how to sell watermelons and bags of potatoes and fruit and vegetables to people that would stop along Route 40 right outside of Worcester, Pennsylvania. And then I would go watch him negotiate in the farmer's market in Pittsburgh at 1 o'clock in the morning when I was about 10 years old. So he really kind of got me started into negotiation and how that all worked. And then I just became a real fan of it all and just enjoyed it. I remember one summer I negotiated the sale of Christmas cards in July. And, you know, whoever thought someone could sell Christmas cards in July, I wasn't smart enough to realize I couldn't do it, but I did. Just on and on from there, I had my own paper routes. I negotiated agreements to mow lawns for apartment houses as a young teenager, 12, 13. That's where it really all started.
In the first interview we did, Jim, you mentioned you negotiated the care of premature twins. Could you elaborate a little bit on that story?
That probably will be one of my long-lasting memories. A client of mine, Bob, and his wife, and I'd been coaching Bob for probably a year and a half, and we've done a lot of good things, had a lot of fun, and he's quite an entrepreneur in his own right. And his wife had premature twin daughters in Chicago. He called me and said, "Jim, I really need your help. One of my daughters has passed away, and my other daughter, Sophie, is just hanging on, and I'm negotiating with the insurance companies, the doctors, and the hospitals. I want Sophie to have the very best care." And I said, "Of course." So we went to work, and I coached that. Long story short, Sophie's now a 14-year-old teenager, but it was a very tedious time, an emotional time for Bob and his wife. And for me, to be very honest, it was very difficult, but we managed to keep a even keel and get through it. Bob was the instigator of Start With No. I never wanted to write a book. I always wanted to stay under the radar. And Bob said, "You've got to write a book. It's going to make a difference to the world, so you got to do this." So he was kind of the instigator, and he found the publisher, the agents. He was a publisher in his own right of magazines. He had lined up all the tools to make it happen, and so here we are. I think the toughest was probably a divorce. I had a divorce after 13 years of marriage. I've now been married for the second time more than 30. So at 13 years of marriage, that was a very difficult, unwanted occurrence, and I had three children. So I think that was the toughest negotiation of all. And why I say that is, following my system, I developed a mission and purpose for the children and the ex-wife and her new family, and it was all to their benefit. And it kept me on an even keel and not emotionally off the reservation, although it was very difficult. But, you know, the proof was in the pudding, and that was over 34 years ago or so, 35 years ago, and something like that.
So were you able to remain friends with the ex?
Well, we weren't really friends for a long
but
time.
But civil.
But we were civil and respectful, and I got everybody to buy into my mission and purpose. The grandparents on both sides, the ex, the ex's new husband, and, you know, we got everybody bought in to the mission and purpose of the children, and the oldest son is now a colonel and a veteran of Iraq. He flew 50 missions in Iraq. He's a graduate of Carnegie Mellon University. Number two son is a graduate of Brown University, where he played quarterback, and he now has a wonderful family, and he's in the finance world. And number three son, who was the youngest in that divorce arena, is now happily married with one handsome little boy and one on the way, and they're all college graduates, and I have two new children. We don't talk about step anything. It's brothers and sisters, so we have five children that are joined at the hip.
How old are your two newest ones?
30 and 27.
Okay, that's great.
And, you know, the other family comes to all the kids' events, and I mean all five of them, football games, birthdays. So I think that was my toughest, but I also think it was the most rewarding.
Describe your biggest negotiating mistake. What did it cost you, and what should you have done differently?
Oh, that's an easy one. I'm going to say it was 1971 or two, and I was still on active duty in the military, and I was home early in December for the holidays, and I'd gone over to the university to say hi to Coach Hayes at Ohio State. He said, "Let's go to lunch, Jim." And I said, "Okay, Coach, let's go." He knew I was coming off active duty, and I very much wanted to get into the business world. And so he took me to lunch at a place called Len Emke's Buick in downtown Columbus, Ohio. Now, it's December, and it's cold. We're standing outside in a line of people around the block, and eventually we get inside this restaurant. It's pretty basic. And there's a real jovial big guy with a white apron, and they're flipping hamburgers, and people are making the hamburgers to go to order. You know, you put your order in and what you want, and it comes out the other end, all freshly made and all that. So I get my hamburger and sit down, and this jovial fella comes over. Of course, you know, everybody knows Coach Hayes in Columbus, so he comes over to Coach, and Woody introduced me to Dave Thomas. And Woody told Dave that I wanted to go to California and get involved in business. He said, "Jim, I'd love to have a young man like you in the organization. Why don't you get $80,000 together, and I'll sell you the franchise for California?" I thought to myself, my gosh, I make $5,500 a year in the military. Where am I going to come with $80,000? And, of course, I don't have the breadth of thought process to think, okay, who can I get to join in with me? How could I do this? It was never that. It was, gee, I can't do that. And I thanked him very much. I told him, I said, I don't know how to do that. I could never do that. I said, well, if you can get that together, I can teach you how to do this. And I just couldn't see how to do it. And I had no mentors at that time, including Coach Hayes, that could tell me how to do it. Since I couldn't see it, they couldn't see it either.
Didn't you ask your dad for the money?
Oh, yeah. He laughed. He thought that was funny. He said, you got to be kidding. Our whole estate's not worth $80,000 at that time. So he hadn't bought his company yet. So that was, to me, my biggest negotiating failure. That fellow's name was Dave Thomas, and that was Wendy's Hamburgers for California. That could have been my franchise.
Do you know who has it now?
No, but it sold 3 years later for $53 million.
Can you give me a little peek into the window of what the 3-plus strategy is?
I had a client, a chief financial officer, and we were working on a contract in Korea in a Silicon Valley company, a big giant out there. And we had a Korean adversary that was disingenuous. At least we thought he was disingenuous because in the past, when we executed a 3-plus, the answers never quite came back the same. So 3-plus is the ability to stay around the topic and comfortably 3 or more times as the adversary lays out the vision around that point. So we designed in the checklist a series of interrogative questions, simple, short, how will that work? What will it look like? Those kinds of things. And we got to 14-plus with this Korean CEO.
14-plus questions?
14-plus. We stayed around the topic of the contract 14 times, and the importance of the contract was a topic. And Bob actually counted the number of times he went back to it in the negotiation over a couple hours. And finally, this Korean CEO said, well, the contract's never going to be valid because I'm going to break it within 6 months anyway. The hidden agenda all along was to break the contract within 6 months, and once he'd gotten the funding, was to force my client into Korean court for the next 3 or 4 years to get it resolved.
But the 14-plus, that strategy by staying on the topic of the contract, did that drive him to reveal his hidden agenda?
Yeah, exactly. It peels back layers of onion, and you can't hide. It's exactly like the FBI or some of the great interrogators of the world who were able to put a criminal down. You know, you ask them the first time, where were you on the night of December 2nd? They'll say, well, I was at my mom's house. And, well, when you were visiting your mom's house on December 2nd, what did you and your mom talk about? Well, we talked about, you know, family things and et cetera, et cetera. And then, well, we're a little confused because in your written statements to these questions, you said you were at your mom's house on December 1st. What are we missing here? So lo and behold, over time, by 3, 4, 10-plussing, that's what plus is all about, at least 3 times but more, you start to bring out the truth. You start to uncover the hidden agendas. And it's not a matter of sticking around that topic until you've got 14 questions asked. That's not the case. You ask early on, then you go to another problem, discuss it. And you say, you know, let me go back. You know, how does it apply to the validity of the contract? So you actually move around and come back to it. And he was absolutely flabbergasted when that Korean CEO said, we're going to break it anyway, and then we'll just spend the next years in court. And Bob had said he didn't realize what he said. I left there, and he didn't even realize he had told me the truth, what his deepest thoughts were. He didn't even know it. Of course, we didn't sign the contract, and, you know, we moved on. But I think that was the greatest, most blatant example. And I remember the board of directors, Bob and I were in the board of directors meeting talking about this, and they looked at us like, you guys are crazy. You know, you were just lucky. That was their whole attitude. And, of course, who are we to try to sell what we're doing to them? You know, I mean, they're the board of directors, so we just said, well, we just hope we get another opportunity to do it again. We did many opportunities, but they always shook their head like, how'd you do that?
That's excellent. Great story.
Now, I'm not saying that you go out and buy a car and pay the very highest price, but I've got to tell you, Michael, it's very easy to do research on a car. For example, my wife insisted on getting a hybrid SUV from GM. First of all, to help GM, all the citizen reasons, help GM, help the taxpayers of the country recover their investment, hybrid, save the environment, all of that, and that's fine. She went on the internet, did her research, found out what the car normally sold for, what the list price was, and I went with her to the dealer, and she said, what do I do? I said, you know what the car is selling for around the country, and you tell them it's okay if they don't want to take this, but you write a check, hand them the check for the amount you're paying that's based on your research around the country, and they're free to reject that. but you expect great service, but they're free to reject that. And they said, oh, no, ma'am, that's a good number. We'd actually given you a little more. And she said, well, I want you to remember me when I come for service. So her mission and purpose, though she paid probably $200 more, believe me, Michael, when she calls service and says, this is Mrs. Camp calling about my hybrid, I need an appointment as quickly as possible to change the oil. Please, Mrs. Camp, bring it right in. We'll give you a loaner while we change the oil. So her mission and purpose was very clear, and she gets great, great service, and she paid them a little more than they would have asked. We just had a situation in China where we had a purchasing agent and a salesperson who, unfortunately, is a win-winner and wanted to give him the store. So they actually gave him a $7 million discount, and thank goodness the purchasing agent rejected it because he thought he could get more. And this was on the mainland of China with a Chinese salesman on our side and a Chinese buyer on their side, and they're supposed to be master negotiators. Here's our salesman giving in to millions of dollars, and thank goodness the purchasing agent rejected it because we pulled the whole thing off the table. And then we went to the real decision makers and created the vision of this kind of discounting that your purchasing people are demanding. There's not going to be R&D. What will you do with the next generation of technology? What will you do when it's not delivered because we can't do the research and development to bring it forward? Michael, they paid full price to get that research and development done. It's really true. I talked to the engineers. I said, wait a minute. If we give up $7 million of margin in this arena, what are the ramifications? And one of the engineers said, well, we've got to cut research by 80%. We'll never get the new technology to market in a reasonable time frame.
So you kept it in their world.
Absolutely.
So their vision was, we're not going to have research and development on the next wave of technology.
And without that next wave of technology, we're going to lose market share. I'll tell a very quick story. I had a great negotiator from one of the largest consulting firms on the earth.
This is someone you were negotiating with?
That's negotiating for my services. And he called me up and he said, you know, Jim, my name is Joe Smith and I've been at this now for 30 years. I'm the head of procurement for XYZ Consulting, and you know we're probably the largest organization in the world, so I'm pretty good at this. He said, I'm going to really enjoy this.
He told you he was going to enjoy it?
Yeah, and I said, gee, that's great. I'll keep my guard up, and I kind of laughed.
When you're negotiating with a guy like that, do you see his game?
Yeah, it's funny. It's kind of sad, actually, but I just laughed and said, don't worry, I'll keep my guard up. And I said, but, you know, I'm kind of stuck in the middle here of a call on the other line, and I didn't actually expect this. Could we schedule a time a little later today and we can get together on this? He said, oh, sure. So we set a time, and he called me back. Of course, in the meanwhile, I'd prepared a checklist, did a little bit of looking up on Google of this outfit. Oh, yeah, I did a little critical research and made my own checklist. I had a mission and purpose.
What was the mission and purpose?
To provide them the greatest opportunity to expand their horizons in negotiation and improve their bottom line.
Was there anything important you found in the research to develop that checklist?
Yeah, they had two down quarters in a row. I found that out, and I also found out there had been a shakeup in upper management. A CFO had been replaced, and a few other things. But the point was is that great negotiator was going to call me. And he called me, and he was trying to use the hammer and anvil tactic of win-win.
Give me an example.
The greatest company in the world is your competitor, meaning so they're the hammer, I'm the anvil, and they're going to beat me with that great competitor, right? So he called me and said, you know, Jim, let's cut to the chase here. I love it when people say that to me. And I said, oh, sure, of course. Go right ahead. So, of course, he's talking. I'm listening, taking notes. He said, now look, we've done our research. I know you've talked to a couple of our senior VPs over the last 2 or 3 months. And he said, we've decided it's between you and Harvard for negotiations training. I said, gee, that's really interesting, but you can't hire me. You can't dare hire me. I'm dead in the water.
You said you can't hire me. Why?
Your career's at stake here. You can't take a risk on a small company like mine compared to the greatest academic institution on the planet. You can't use me. And Michael, here's what he said. He said, absolutely. He said, you know, I've been given permission to hire either one of you. I said, let me just ask you, why in the world would you take the risk to hire me in this arena? He said, well, because everybody in the company knows that the Harvard stuff doesn't work.
Yeah.
He actually said that. World's class negotiator.
That is so funny.
It was bizarre. And he said, now, Jim, Harvard's going to do this. Their pricing is $400,000 over a year's time. And they're going to travel around the world for $400,000 and do 2-day workshops all over the world. I said, well, that's not what I do. I said, I teach a system, and then I coach that system, and I utilize the internet, the telephone, but workshops and travel are a waste of time. Now, I'll do the workshop as introductions, if you like, and pricing, I'm going to have to charge you upwards of $14,500 a person. He said, what? I said, the price of coaching, you know, it's very intense and it's very demanding. And if you're just looking for workshops, I just can't do that and not produce results. It wasn't even in the ballpark, Michael. There were 100 people to be trained. It was a whole different world, and they hired me. You know, I think that the whole key is that performance is everything. In fact, I've had dealings with an investment banker who was going to have documents for a client on Monday, and then on Wednesday, still no documents. And then a call to him on Friday, and the lawyer's been so busy, and then they'll absolutely be to you there next Wednesday. And I hope that your listener starts to see the pattern. It becomes very clear very quickly that it's all had and no cattle. So it's time to break. It's time to move on. It's time to let that go and move on to do what I call a fadeaway. Just move on and find another investment banker to talk with. Let me give you an example of getting it right. One of my greatest achievements is I owned a fundraising company, and we were looking for another product, a really class product to take to schools. And I had, out of the blue, called Nabisco Brands in Upper Saddle River, New Jersey. Unbeknownst to me, they had purchased 10 or 12 of the finest cookie companies in Europe who had these cookies in tins, these beautifully crafted, painted tins. This is back in the 70s. And I went to Upper Saddle River to negotiate getting the ability to use an Nabisco Brands label on all of our materials and advertising and sales kit for our students in the schools. And I made a mistake. I had all my documents with me, I had all my information with me, I had everything I needed with me in the car, and I left my briefcase in the car and got all the way to the gate of the airplane. The airplane was boarding without my briefcase, and I thought, well, now what do I do? So I got on the airplane, went to Upper Saddle River, New Jersey, sat down in the boardroom and talked with the powers to be, and I said, I have to apologize, but I left my briefcase in the car in Columbus. I was so excited to come and visit with you. And I guess the way I'd like to start the meeting with you is, why would you consider a small company like mine to have the opportunity to market and sell Nabisco cookies? And that's where we started. And I didn't present anything. And they said, well, what would you have to do this? And I said, I'm going to need inventory, but I don't have my numbers with me, but I can call you and give you those. And I said, but more importantly, I'd like to have permission to use your trademark in the schools to help market the cookies. And they said, that's not a problem. We can take care of that. And I got everything I want, and I had nothing to show. So I was in their world discovering their challenges, their problems, and that's what I'm asking this person who's fundraising to do. What is the problems of that committee? What are they trying to solve? It's phenomenal what you can do when you have a system. Well, I've coached labor negotiations on both sides, and I've got to tell you, there's no such thing as power in a negotiation. That's a myth. That is a self-induced emotional state. When you think someone else has the power, you're putting yourself in a fearful position, and it clouds your vision, and it has a negative effect on the decision-making. I've been on the side of management where management had, according to the newspapers and according to a lot of people, were over a barrel, quote-quote, by labor, and we got pay concessions, and we created vision about the importance of those pay concessions and the job security of the union members. On the other side of the coin, I was on the labor side, where we created vision of value and the importance of standard of living for the families and the health care of the families and the performance of their duties that were very valuable. So it all boils down to the creation of vision and how we're seen. But there is no such thing as power. All that does is heighten the emotions and create fear. So that's step one in our whole system. And I would recommend strongly that the person who was kind enough to submit the question really dig into what we're doing, because it'll pay a lot of dividends for them.
How do I negotiate with my son without sounding like a dictator?
That is a great question. And I think that if I could ever get this across, it would be very, very helpful. I think it's very important that you influence your son so he has a vision of the value of what you're trying to deliver to him. I tell a story all the time about one of my sons. I remember it was a fun story. He came home from third grade and said, "Dad, I'm not going to school tomorrow." Now, this is a youngster that was an A student and a wonderful student. And I was fearful that maybe he was being picked on. Now, he's a pretty tough kid. But I was fearful that something was going on in school. And I said, "Why wouldn't you want to go to school?" He said, "Well, you know, Jimbo's home from college." This was in May. "Jimbo's home from college, Dad, and we don't get to see him. And I don't want to go to school tomorrow. I think I'd rather go to work with Jimbo." And I said, "Okay, that's great. Why don't we pack a lunch and have you go to work with Jimbo in the morning? He's working in carpentry work here on the ranch, and so you can pass up lumber to him, and you can work with him all day, and it's only going to be 95 degrees here, and you're going to have a great time."
And Jimbo's his brother.
Jimbo's a big brother, and this is a third grader. Jimbo's a college football player, and a little brother wants to be one. And so Brian gets this vision, this is going to be really great, right? And Mom packs a lunch, and off he goes with Jimbo. And we let him miss school that day. And, you know, he went down, and at about 12 o'clock, he came dragging up the driveway and said, "I think I'm going to go to school tomorrow."
That's funny.
He discovered it'd be more fun to be with Jimbo after Jimbo gets off work, jumping in the swimming pool, than being at the workplace all day. School was a pretty cool place to be. So that was a discovery process. But the ability to help these kids discover where they can go and where they can be and what they can do. I know my oldest son, Jim, I was a pilot in another life. In fact, when Jim was a youngster, he used to see me fly the jets around the pattern at an Air Force base I flew at, because our house was close enough to where the fighters flew around the pattern, and I'd fly over the house, and I'd give him a call and tell him what time I was flying, and between such and such time I'll be in the pattern, I'll rock my wings, and Jimmy and all his little buddies would see me rock my wings. Deep in my heart, I wanted him to be a pilot, but it's like every dad does. But I also knew that it was a dangerous arena, so he had to want to be there. So I just never really played it up and never talked to him about it. And then one day in college, he called and said, "Dad, I just went to a U2 concert, and a flight of four fighters just came through the stadium, and I realized I want to be like you. I want to be a fighter pilot." But that was in college, and so you always hope they have that discovery. But that discovery, that vision, is going to be the driving force. So when you're dealing with your children, if you can create that vision, it's very powerful.
Yeah, those are great stories. Thanks for sharing.
I just helped coach a negotiation for a job, actually a career move, and it was very interesting because the vision was created of past performance and future performance, and the vision was created of this ownership of this system of negotiation that brought about in the current accomplishments in the current job that would move them into this other organization. They were actually working while they were going through the interview process. They're being recruited. And the other party doing the recruiting actually had a vision that this was a person they needed to bring on board. So they actually made an offer that almost doubled the income of this person to get them out of where they were into this new opportunity. That was 9 months ago, and that person's been promoted twice since, simply because they had a system and they helped the other party see the system and how it worked and how they were able to perform the way they were. So it's how you create the vision. Now, one of the things we did years ago with Lee Iacocca at Chrysler, I called his assistant and asked her what would be required of us that you would look at or you would embrace that would allow us to speak to Mr. Iacocca. At that time, he was the head of Chrysler.
Why were you calling him?
We were calling him because we had a financial solution in Japan for Chrysler Motor Company. But he did not know us. He did not know who I was working with. And so the bottom line was we needed to know the agenda that they required to speak with Mr. Iacocca without having a prior introduction from some other party, which is, quote, quote, a cold call. She gave us her requirements, and my client spoke with Mr. Iacocca.
What'd she say? Do you remember?
Okay, she wanted to know who would be doing the talking, what are their credentials, and she gave us a list of requirements. We fulfilled them. We sent a Federal Express package overnight with her requirements, and lo and behold, an appointment was set.
I mean, that strategy right there could solve so many cold calling problems if the cold call would be right to the blocker and ask, what are the requirements for me to get through to Mr. CEO?
That's exactly right. What are the problems you face here? How do we do this? I remember a long time ago in another life, I remember I was a new jet pilot, and I joined a squadron that was being transitioned from props to jets. So a lot of the older guys were propeller pilots, and they had habits based on propeller flight that I didn't have. And I watched the struggle for them to change those habits over time. And honestly, some of them didn't make it. They couldn't change the habits, but they can be changed.